Great. Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. I know mornings after Rave can be a bit of a struggle, so appreciate you all being here. So I'll do a bit of an introduction to myself and the Ethereum Foundation Next Billion program, and then I'll pass it on to the brilliant panelists we have up on stage. So my name is Marcus. I am a fellow at the Ethereum Foundation, where I am currently researching the implementations of last mile DeFi, focusing primarily in Latin America, and essentially asking ourselves, how can we leverage DeFi to not just, you know, bring financial gain, but actually empower livelihoods in a very real, very tangible way. So always happy to talk about these things at a later stage. And context-wise, into the Next Billion team, really the essence of Next Billion is to ask ourselves, how can we leverage Ethereum and Web3, not just to onboard the Next Billion users, but to create tangible, very visceral changes in their lives, and do so at a very scalable level. So with that, I will pass it on to the three panelists here to my left and allow them to introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about what they're working on.
Hi, I'm Abhishek Bhattacharya. I'm one of the co-founders at a project called Whirl. What we do is we are a CeFi to DeFi bridge. We started 3 years back helping farmers, enabling farmers take loan against their crops that they can store. Right after harvesting, farmers receive very less price for the crops price for the crops that they grow. We enable them, we encourage them to store it in a warehouse, in a government or a private warehouse, and sell it off after 3 or 4 months when the prices are 40% or even sometimes 100, 200% better. We use blockchain to do that, to bring banks on the table. We'll be discussing about that as well, that how we brought banks onto blockchain. And that is what we've been doing. Now we are going on to decentralized finance soon, so that the same farmers in a country like India and maybe everywhere else can get access to DeFi lending as well.
Thank you. So I'm Gabriela. I'm from Mexico. I am working on Bloinx, B-L-O-I-N-X. That's an application, decentralized application, that manages saving circles. You might know them as tandas, cuchuales, cheat funds, or many ways around the world. That's a way of people to actually, let's say, get an interest-free loan, if you're one of the first, from your friends or your family members. And if you're the last, you're actually contributing for them to get this loan. Why this is important for us in Mexico, in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, it's not easy for us to get a loan. And if we get one, it's super normal to have 50% interest rate, 100%, and people don't read the small letters. So we get into very big debt. So this is why it's important to give them options to actually have these, let's say, social credit options. So that's what we're doing.
Hello, everyone. My name is Benson Juguna. I come from Kenya. We've been working with smallholder farmers, with Eka Africa, solving the insurance problem. So agri-insurance has been a problem where we have very low penetration. For years, it has been around 3% of the smallholders taking up insurance. And we feel it's important for them to take up insurance and many other traders who are earning an income, because we were able to protect them, because lack of insurance has left most of the farmers exposed to hunger, because after a climate effect, then no food, then it means they can't sell, because it also the food has been affected, meaning no income, and a whole cycle of unfavorable things. So with that, we are doing this, solving the problems that are making them not take up insurance, and blockchain has helped us to do some of these things, which we'll discuss as we go on. Thank you, Marcus.
Awesome, thank you. So yeah, an incredible group of people here doing amazing work, really just changing people's lives in a very real sense using, you know, this technology. So I mean, just before, maybe to set a little bit of context, we could just go around and just perhaps lay the scene of, you know, we've got India, Latin America, and Africa up here on stage. Across each of your respective regions, what is it about the traditional systems and our current incumbent systems that are set in place that are currently falling short, for whether it's for farmers or for local communities and saving circles? Where are traditional incumbent institutions falling short? And on the other side of the equation there, what is it unique? What is unique about DeFi that enables your proposition to be unlocked through leveraging, you know, distributed ledgers, et cetera? So maybe, Abhi,
sure.
Kick it off to you.
Sure. Currently in India, everywhere else also, as we are expanding globally, we've seen many other countries. The systems that are in place, for example, talking about the loans that we give to farmers, these are centralized finance loans given by banks since ages. It's not something we brought on. But there's a lot of fraud in that. And that's, of course, fraud is the biggest thing that blockchain solves anyway. That's where blockchain finds most use case in fintech. So as a fintech organization, we saw that the government systems, the banking systems, the entire platform that is available to the farmers and to the banks is not sufficient. And blockchain could help. Banks were pulling out of this entire ecosystem, leaving farmers into the hands of usurious money lenders with outrageous interest rates. So that's one you know, drawback that systems like in India, the government organizations, they have. And you talked about DeFi. DeFi is a very new thing. Farmers, of course, have nothing to do with DeFi, like to understand the concept. But it is at play at the back end, where I personally believe that it's access to, so as we say, there are more than 1.7 billion unbanked people across the globe. With DeFi, we do not have to just go wait for a bank to process the loans, even though if it's in real time, it's still 15 minutes, 30 minutes. That's as real time as it gets for the farmers at this moment. But with DeFi, it is access to the global DeFi capital. And on the other hand, it's a good thing for the DeFi lenders as well, because they get access to really stable assets, not against speculative crypto. These are crops, non-perishable crops, maize, soybean, rice, anything you name it. And that's where they would be interested in driving the DeFi capital, and we would be interested in replacing those systems that are already there and the shortcomings with this new system helped by DeFi, blockchain, Web3 altogether.
Hey, so situation in Mexico, right? Right now with the Ethereum Foundation, we're I'm going to focusing on women. What's the situation there? So we have legally a 48-hour work week. So imagine a family, a single mom that has two kids, has to work 48 hours, and then has to take transportation, then she has no time. We don't have a good healthcare system, well, a child to daycare system, so it's difficult. So what option do they have? Informality. There are 2 billion people around the world, talking now about next billion, we have 2 billion people around the world that are uninformally employed. Why? Because of this, because they sell informally, because they're farmers. So this is the situation. They live day to day. They either bake cakes, sell creams, do massages, or whatever thing they might think of. So it's difficult. What happens when they need, they have medical emergency with their kids? They need cash, right? They try to get it from a centralized financial institution, but what happens is that they require a proof of income, which they don't have. So this is a serious issue. They have this option of getting loans from informal lenders, but it's super high interest rates, or they have this other option. Why? These options already exist. These options have been there for 100 years in many countries. What you do there is you put in your social credit, right? So why blockchain? Well, it's decentralized. You can join a saving circle. Yes, you have the same risks of a common saving circle, but we can exploit their traceability. We know exactly what was deposited and when it was deposited and then to who it was paid to. So that's super important. In our case, where we have a lot of corruption and people doing non, let's say, legal or correct ethical things. So this is important for us. And also we can leverage a reputation system that can eventually serve as a foundation for them to actually get a loan from a financial institution for a bigger amount. So this is why blockchain is there. Everything is on-chain. So it's permanent, immutable, and not subject to change by anyone. So that's why.
Wow. I'll cue what Gabriela said. So in DeFi, in our context in Africa, case in point in Kenya, we have mobile money. as is a digital technology. For example, in Kenya, it has over 98% adoption, meaning almost every adult citizen has a wallet, a mobile money wallet. But we still find challenges in how much they're paying, how much they're paying for the loans. So we have very high interest on the loans. In fact, they are regarded as predatory. In fact, even the central bank has been tracking down. So this access to finance has been a challenge because of high interest rates. And when it comes now to DeFi to protect, for example, income. So a farmer has income. Why are we saying DeFi can help solve the problem? So for us, it was the transparency in the traditional insurance business. So an agent will go to the field, convince a farmer to buy insurance, but then keep quiet for a whole 6 months. The season would take around 6 months. Next time they see the agent will be next time they're selling. So no information. Didn't know what policy they took, what was happening about it. Now with blockchain, we're able to enable the farmer using feature phones. The penetrations of feature phones is high. To dial a number and they're able to see so far your policy has triggered this percentage, which is equivalent to this amount of money. And also the triggers that were used to say determine whether they qualify for a claim or not are tamper evident, so we generate hashes, put them on chain, so you can, to prove, you just need to produce the hash and compare it with the data, since we don't publish the farmer data on chain. But yeah, that's how we DeFi and blockchain is revolutionizing financing.
Incredible, amazing. I find it really interesting that each of you is sort of working through different sectors. You're working very much so, you know, with governments and large regulators as well, and trying to figure out a lot of the real world asset integration as well. And Gabriela, you're very much so kind of working with local, women led cooperatives and figuring out like how do you download and work with MetaMask, for example. We were talking about that earlier, right? And how you even would, you know, add Polygon to your MetaMask wallet and just thinking about what that user experience is like. And then Benson, like you're tying in all this technology that already exists out in the world too, right? And you're saying, hey, we've got M-Pesa, USSD transactions as well, and we're tying in, you know, climate data. And so I just appreciate the breadth to which each of you is leveraging this. And on that point, I mean, perhaps Abhi, you could paint a little bit of that picture of what it's been like working with kind of incumbent institutions in your jurisdiction, right? So you mentioned you're speaking with banks, you're speaking with, you know, regulators in the space as well. You're very much so working with real-world assets, which is just a fascinating concept in and of itself, too. So I wonder if you could shed a little bit of a light on that, because that's been a really sort of hot topic in the space recently, how we integrate real-world assets within DeFi. So maybe you can shed some light on that.
Yes, I mean, I understand, because the entire blockchain ecosystem has always been wondering that how do banks and governments fit in with the ecosystem, how to bring them on board. I have met so many people here, people working with the Colombian government, I work with the Indian government, he's working with the Kenyan government. So definitely now banks and governments and all those institutions have started opening up to, you know, to adopting blockchain-based systems. But then there are certain boundaries that you always would have to keep in mind. So for example, we could not have just asked a bank to come and join us on a public blockchain, right? Like Ethereum, Polygon. But on the other hand, so it has to be designed very specifically so that you can take them in confidence. One very important thing about banks and, especially big banks, right? And in India, there are a handful of big banks, big orgs. And is that their sales cycles are too long, because it's just how they are, right? And further crossing the barrier of going onto a blockchain platform, internally they have that bureaucracy as well. That is a tough sell already. But one thing we have constantly seen in our use case is that not a single bank has ever said that, no, this is not something we want. Because again, this is not a domain. This is called warehouse receipt finance. You store a crop, you take a loan against it. It's as simple as that. It is one of the oldest lending products known to mankind. What we did was we just made it better. Right? But banks knew it, and banks have been facing these frauds since decades. So, and they tried solving it with legacy technologies, which they haven't been able to. So they were open to adopting blockchain, right? They knew firsthand, there's a very clear distinction here. Firsthand, they knew we are only talking about blockchain technology and we are not talking about cryptocurrency. blockchain, the banks on blockchain will barely ever get involved with cryptocurrency, at least in such use cases, not in the ones where we are talking about CBDC or cross-border payments, etc. But here they had to be very clear. So what we did was to onboard them, we created a permission blockchain, which Quorum, which was built by JP Morgan, so came as a perfect use case that JP Morgan is running a 400 bank strong network on the same blockchain, so why not we use the same thing? And then when the banks were on board, we also talked to the governments, of course, as much as possible, reaching out. There are state governments in India. And then they saw that, okay, there's an opportunity, no cryptocurrency involved. The Indian government has been very supportive of blockchain. I mean, you know, we have seen, we have heard the Indian, Honorable Indian Prime Minister, Shri Narendra Modi, we have seen him speak about blockchain at the Singapore FinTech Festival last year. He was very, very, you know, praiseworthy for blockchain. So the government accepts it really, till the time we do not bring cryptocurrency. The challenge here is that bringing DeFi onto the same platform, which is where things become very complicated, which is something we're trying to navigate even at this moment. We are trying to keep them separate. Banks won't be interacting with the crypto ecosystem. The crypto DeFi lenders won't be interacting with the CeFi lenders. But the farmer should be benefited. So the farmer, on the click of a button on a multilingual app, would be having access to whether to take this moment, this crop, loan against that particular crop in DeFi or in CeFi. That's what we are trying to abstract. It's a challenge. It's still a challenge. I'm pretty sure that Kenya and Latin America, they would be facing the same problems, because it's just how it is. I mean, you know, it's just a decade of blockchain that we've seen. Governments are not ready to accept it just at the first go. That's what we've seen.
Yeah, it's true. For example, in our project, we were dealing with the insurance regulator. So you have to prove that you're not using crypto. So you don't need to mention crypto. We start with efficiency. So we are bringing a technology that will do exactly what has been happening, but now we can pay claims immediately at the end of the season. You don't have to wait for 6 months. So after a while, the Kenya government is really good. The regulator has what we call a sandbox. So it gives any crazy idea to apply and say, we want to try out this and this and this. So part of this sandbox is where we are now trying to see how can we introduce risk crypto-based risk pools, where now we can pay out from a certain risk pool that has been funded by the community, like the DeFi community Abby's talking about. So the regulator has been, start with the technology and then crypto later.
Yeah, I mean, we've obviously seen a lot of regulatory talk, and that, you know, necessarily what we'll sort of get bogged down on throughout much of this conversation, but it is a really important consideration, right? Especially if we want to reach sort of critical mass, if we want to do integrations with wider partners as well, thinking about how we do that, definitely will take a lot of thought and you know, having even sort of these spaces for all of us to say, hey, these are the benefits of DeFi, here is how, and I think being able to align with traditional financial institutions and governments and regulators and saying, listen, these are the benefits that comes to you. I think oftentimes there's obviously this very oppositional position that comes up when we speak about DeFi in emerging markets and around the world, right? So, and we've seen the likes of Uniswap with the DeFi Education Fund as well, really push for more education, more advocacy at the regulatory level, which is obviously hugely, hugely important. But switching over, you know, gears a little bit, Gabriela, I think one of the really fascinating things, and Abby was touching on this too, was the idea that what you're offering, Abby, for example, isn't necessarily new, right? And being able to warehouse financing isn't a particularly new innovation. Problem is that the traditional financial institutions haven't quite been serving last mile communities because there isn't enough value for them to engage with as they do these things. So, Gabriela, also with the tandas, you know, there's something really interesting there as well, where, as you said, you know, these are traditions that are hundreds of years old. So particularly with DeFi, like what is it about tandas and decentralized finance that unlocks that value and really enables people to be able to do this at scale?
Yes, we're people. We like tradition, especially in markets like Latin America. We do what our parents and grandparents did because it's just how we are. We're a very familiar, community. So what happens if you, for example, someone tells you, hey, get into crypto because you can pool your funds and then you can put it in a farm and then you get the yield and then you're a farmer and it's like, right? tell this to a mom who lives day by day and has very few to actually take that risk, right? So what happens there is that this is a way to get them with a known thing, right? They all know saving circles. They already have been in many of these many times. So you take this something known into the blockchain, and then you get them, hey, you can use your wallet. You're using your saving circle, but they don't know they're using a dApp. So eventually they will be able to get loans, to stake, to eventually get into a pool and do whole DeFi things, right? And they can, that can unlock like that fear of what's this, right? That yield, and it's just too much information from the beginning. So these tools that are things that have already been happening many years can enable these to go to an audience that may not be that technologically savvy, but has a need for these technologies. And they can use it for something very tangible, just like we saw with UBI, right? For pay for uniforms for school or for a medical emergency or for something that could really benefit them in day by day, right? So that's why we think these types of tools known could be good for these next billion users we're looking at.
Yeah, case in point in Kenya as well, what or in Africa, to actually have a farmer operate a wallet and they can deposit and withdraw, it's, yes, as Gabriela puts it, it's quite hard. It will take time as to train, but we see an additional layer of, we call it custodians. So for example, we have a payment gateway, an on-ramp, off-ramp called Kotani Pay. We have BitLipa in Kenya doing a good job. So what they do, they store the keys for the farmer and now translate each wallet into a USSD-based wallet. So a farmer would dial *800#. They'll see, oh, access your wallet. Oh, yeah, withdraw to M-Pesa, because M-Pesa is their mobile money. They can withdraw. But you see, they're used to the USSD, they're used to M-Pesa. The part of wallet connection, somebody else is doing it at another level for them. And with time, as we get more adoption of smartphones, because also smartphone is an issue, we have like a third of the people have smartphones, or two-thirds, and the third is the one that still has the feature phones, the button ones. So once we see more of smartphones coming in, then we feel more people will be able to control the DeFi wallets on themselves. And yeah, and also we other strategies that we are introducing, the government is really keen on capital flight. So on-ramp, you changing your local currency to USDC, for example. So if we start with projects that bring in money into the country, for example, there's Diva Protocol and Fortune Connect. We tapping donations globally and reaching and pushing through like this off-ramp to the farmer. So the farmer is able to access USSD and withdraw, for example, a donation. But then this has started introducing them to DeFi. So they'll see, oh, with time. So this money was crypto. Now I have converted it to my local currency. Ah, so we can slowly move down from the custodians of keys to actually having them be the holders of their own keys with time. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. The work Acre Africa is doing, by the way, is super fascinating, right? So they're essentially when I learned about your project, I was super blown away, right? The fact that you can essentially sort of execute these transactions utilizing USSD and integrate that with M-Pesa just speaks so much to the composability of these different sort of building blocks and Legos. But I'd love to, and you mentioned as well, like mobile phones, right? We've seen an increase in traction with mobile phone use as well. And when it comes to crypto, we're still super far off. I tried editing an ENS record today on my cell phone, on my MetaMask. It was like such a pain. And so mobile phone sort of integration with wallets and generally just like crypto is still really far off. And I think that is a huge, huge unlock for, you know, there are more cell phones in Colombia than there are people, right? So when you think about what that means for the development of a technology, that's really powerful. So the question is, you know, and maybe starting with you, Benson, what do you feel are really the sort of at the end user experience perspective, What are the big unlocks that are missing for DeFi here? You know, I'm sure we've got a room here full of people that are really keen to get building and are already exploring sort of problem spaces and solutions. So maybe we can touch a little bit on the current sort of end user challenges and what you believe are really the underlying underlocks. And maybe we can work our way backwards here to get each of your thoughts on those aspects.
Thank you, Marcus. The biggest two challenges that we see is capacity building. For them to understand that this is as good as M-Pesa, it's just crypto. How do you make them understand that it's not fraud? Because then that comes to my second point. We need to deal with the trust. If we deal with them knowing how to work with it, then bringing tools, introducing slowly, building on the blocks, off-ramp solution, connect to M-Pesa. Then with time, you can go directly to the off-ramp, directly, they can now directly trade. They don't have to really withdraw, because you'd ask a farmer, what's your incentive? You have been, you've received a donation in USDC. Why are you withdrawing it to M-Pesa? You can go to that merchant, and whatever you wanted to buy, still buy, and it will avoid the transactional fees that are in between here. So dealing with trust, dealing with knowledge, and also, yeah, trying to reduce as much as possible the transaction fees. Transaction fees are a big issue, and the interests that come in between these transactions. We think those are the building blocks that can really bring a lot of adoption. And also smartphone. The more smartphones people have, then more control of their own DeFi gateways.
Right. So smartphones, I think, are key. In Mexico, it's the same thing. People have phones, they access internet through their phones, but have no computers or anything, right? So we see that. I think one thing that I've come up with is that there are many people that with this FOMO or with our situation, desperation, I don't know how to call it, they want to get rich right away, right? So we see a lot of people that actually got scammed, and getting one person that got scammed, like let's say at the beginning in their journey, it's super hard for them to get them back in again. So we see that happening. We see there are people that have not good intentions and that are making it very, very hard for people like all of these people here that are trying to make something good. So that's why you're not mentioning crypto at all, right?
Yeah.
So so that's a real challenge. One person that got scammed once is going to convince 50 people, right. But one person that uses it, how many people you think is going to actually convert? Let's say in a word, 2 or 3 people. So that's a challenge. UX, fortunately, many tools have been translated to Spanish and to different languages around the world, but we still need that community feeling, because in Latin America, we are like very close. We like being in community, doing things in community. So community, I think, is key. So we have a lot of, people building these communities. Now we need to reach that next billion, right? So we need to reach out, not just communities to keep to themselves, but how can we make that scalable? Let's say, not just convert once, and then you get your crypto friends, and then you have your 50 crypto friends, and that's it. How can you get that sense of community scalable in a trustworthy way? So I think that's an interesting question. And UX, I think, is super important. Having applications, we now see more and more crypto applications mobile first, which is great. Having just enough information in the screen that you need, I think that's super important to research and to actually not just research with crypto people, research with the next billion, right? Because we're used to having your balance here, your wallet here, but what do new users actually need, right? So that's a good question, I believe.
Yeah.
For us, it has been a very interesting case study. What we did was we created a multilingual app. It's available in English first, Hindi then, and then Marathi, which is another regional language in India. So what happened was we thought that, okay, multilingual app is going to be very good. When we launched it, we saw that, okay, the adoption is definitely not that much. So what happened was, what basically happened, we redesigned the entire system 2 years back again, right after launching, and we put all those same functionalities, which is available to the farmer from their phone, we put that on the custodian's end, because we have given products to everyone to use, web-based or mobile-based, so that the farmer can just walk in, which is the easiest thing to do, and just request the custodian that, please help me take a loan against it. 6 months, 8 months down the line, or 1 year down the line, gradually, we were surprised again. We saw that farmers have actually started liking the app. I don't know, we did not roll out any major upgrade, we did not add any more languages, it was there, what was there. But then I think somewhere, the custodian started making the farmers believe that it is a very simple app to use. Just try it once, let me guide you, use the app, and then see how it looks. And then they found that, yes, it's a one-click process, one-click loan application. They are not accustomed to, like everyone else, us, they are not accustomed to getting food delivered on phone, getting insurance booked on the click of a button. For them, this was the first ever such application that they were seeing in their lives. And now they have become very confident using it. And as you said that, you know, one person, how many people would they say, would they, you know, speak to regarding the benefits that they've received? In our case, word of mouth has really worked. Because farmers are very close, right? It's a very small community. They have been there in that area since generations. They know which warehouse is nearby, which custodian is nearby, where they have to go. They just, with that word of mouth, and they just started telling everyone that, hey, do you know, I mean, I just got loan in 15 minutes. I mean, in my life, my father has never seen it. I have never seen it. And whenever it happened, it was like 13 to 15 days running post to pillar at banks. And then you know, getting the loan. And whenever you're running there, you are not basically not farming and you're not earning. So this was very, very revolutionary for them. And now we can see that that adoption gap has really bridged, because now they're comfortable. As we move to other states, so India has a lot of regional languages, right? Hundreds or thousands, I think. So we would be just onboarding new languages, which is not a difficult thing for our developers to do. Once we do that, we have cracked that, okay, with the support of technology and with on-ground support, and which is already there from the government. We don't have to deploy our boots on the ground. So I think that is something that is working really well for farmers in India. And I believe another thing that comes to my mind is, in India, again, same thing as you said, more phones than people in Colombia. India, huge population, 1.4 billion people. But one thing is that with a lot of changes in fintech, in technology, almost every other person is having a phone now. Not feature phone, a smartphone, right? There are very cheap phones. If I talk about Indian rupees, it's about, what, 6,000, 5,000 Indian rupees? Maybe $70, $80. So people are buying these smartphones, and now they are onboarded onto the technology. Every single you know, the cart, roadside cart or vendor or you know, the auto wallas, right, the local auto wallas, everyone has a QR code. You can just scan it and pay it. It's not just us paying via QR code anymore. It's almost everyone paying via QR, has started paying via QR code. That helps us. That acts as a tailwind for us, because they already have been using the phones. We just say that, okay, let me open an app in your phone, and that's it. Now start using this app for this part of your life, and it'll all be solved. And then they're very looking forward to that. So that has helped us a lot. In a country like India, when we are going outside, we'll see what other countries use, so we'll have to adapt to that.
Yeah, maybe to contribute to the user interface to onboard more farmers. So it's a combination of the user interface and user experience. Case in point, in one of the example in selling insurance, initially selling insurance, the agent would work with a folder with forms. You would fill in, the farmer would fill in, must sign, etc. So bringing a user interface that is almost similar. So we started with scratch cards. So a scratch card that they would scratch, reveal a certain number, and then now use the phone, the USSD, to send that number, and automatically that's how they were onboarded into insurance. We'd collect now information in that way, technologically wise, using triangulation. You leave them behind with a card and they'll say, oh, this is my insurance, the card. But actually the insurance is something cannot touch. But if such people now over time are able to dial the USSD code without having to scratch a card or remain with something, since they've trusted the process. So that journey has to start somewhere, slowly bring them in and build that. So we see the need for user experience that is well thought out. Yeah.
Just to add to that, I mean, you're solving the insurance problem, honestly. So I have tried selling insurance before. So before starting this organization, I was with a company called Policy Bazaar, which is an Indian unicorn, sells insurance. Even selling insurance in an automated way to urban people, to educated people, is a difficult task. So with farmers, I'm pretty sure it's a daunting task. But if it's getting solved, then I think the farmers are really getting a good service.
One question to all of you. Like, you mentioned how much time do they actually
spend
to get a loan?
Yeah.
How much time is it?
Earlier it was 13 to 15 days. Now it's 10 to 15 minutes, which is like real time for them.
Perfect. So what about Guatemala?
Yeah, so I was, we held a side event the other day, and I mentioned this anecdote earlier, but I was sitting at the dinner table with my dad, and we were talking about, you know, I think he's yet to become a full-on sort of crypto convert. We're working on it, but we were sitting at the dinner table, and I was like, hey, let's both sit down on our phones and try and get a loan. So he went on his, like, mobile banking app, had to fill out, like, a 20-minute survey, da-da-da-da, input all these different things. And he's like, oh, they'll get back to me in 2 weeks. I went on Aave, put up a, you know, over-collateralized loan, done in 5 seconds, right? And I was like, check it out. Here's my money. And so I think, you know, literally in Guatemala, it could take a number of weeks to get a loan. And that's the magic of this, right? And that's sort of a little bit of what the anecdote shows is, you know, a matter of seconds.
Right. Same in Mexico. I don't know.
In Kenya, because of the mobile money wallet, you can get a loan instantly. But now you pay heavily. By the time you calculate, it's over 120% interest. So, yeah.
That's really common, by the way, for those of you that are surprised. In emerging economies...
For us, it's a normal interest rate.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can pay... Like, you know it's bad when the interest rate is posted daily, and it's like 2% daily. Wow. So, yeah, this is the reality of the countries that, you know, we're in, and this is what DeFi is here to disrupt and promise, right? When you think about the fact that you can take out a loan on DeFi for, you know, 3-5%, obviously there's a lot of questions here around the collateral, et cetera, but the reality is, it's, you know, there's a lot to be said for how can we bring down, you know, interest rates that are hundreds of percentage points, thousands at times, down to, you know, single percentage points. So, just, we will do just like one last question, and this will be just a bit of a go around, and then we'd love to open it up to the audience for a bit of Q&A in the last 10 minutes. We've got a room here, obviously, of people that are all largely probably very familiar with the space and the ecosystem, and the question would be, and we spoke previously about what are the challenges on the other side, right? So what are the challenges for the end users in Africa, in Asia, and in Latin America as well? But I guess I'd like to flip the question on the other side of that is like, what's coming back to the Ethereum ecosystem by deploying these solutions, right? We're no longer becoming a self-referential system. We're actually able to draw in a lot of feedback and a lot of input around user experience, around mobile phone adoption, you know, all these other things. So if maybe we can just spend like a few minutes on that, and then we'll turn it over to the audience for a quick Q&A. So yeah, just feel free to take it away on what can the Ethereum community learn from deploying last mile DeFi solutions.
Let me start with what the community has done when it realizes you're doing something. So for us, when we said, okay, we need to solve this problem, we immediately got support from the community. The Ethereum community is passionate. The people who are here, I believe most of the people are here, are passionate. So the first help we got was from EtherRisk. They had built a generic insurance framework, and they said, okay, you can build your application on top. We'll give you technical support, and we'll give you time, and we'll always ensure that you're able to run it. We received support from the foundation, Ethereum Foundation. They helped in the networking. And we also, Chainlink heard about it because we are using weather data to determine whether to pay a claim or not. So they say, how can we help to ensure that your source of truth is actually a source of truth? And not only that, moreover, financially, they got a lot of financial support, got a lot of human people spending time with you, people, experts who are very busy spending time with you to help you. And also now with that, I think we can say the community and what people should do. If you hear of a good project, I think we couldn't have been here if people didn't just come and jump in and helped in the journey. So we could say, let's be lights on the paths of starting projects, and you will see great impact because of that. So I could say that's on the support the community has helped. And now what are we seeing the community learning? You see, like lessons learned for us, the community is able to understand. You can't just directly bring in crypto and you expect the farmer to use. So these research lessons, other people now are able to apply on their different projects if they need to reach the last mile customers. Thank you.
Well, first, I would like to say that, well, if we are onboarding people from our countries that, let's say, as I said, live day by day, we're bringing in people that can use this to benefit in their real life, and we can bring actually these examples and get the community and in give it, let's say, more empathy, right? Because sometimes we are, we're here, we have a roof, we have air conditioning, and we're not if it rains, there's no problem. We can go out and get water and drinks and go to a bathroom, and we have everything, right? So getting these people into the space could be very interesting, because that way we could maybe be sensible to the realities of others and how can they benefit. So I think empathy is an interesting part. And also, we're bringing in people that actually need financing, need things. So we can actually also balance the offer and demand. So that could also be interesting for community.
Yeah. So talking about giving back to the Ethereum community, right? Or bringing the Ethereum community on board. Ethereum has reached millions, right? And that's what the purpose of the next objective is, to reach the next billion. With all these projects, so these are a few handful of the projects in Kenya, India, Latin America. There are so many more projects that are already on Ethereum or on one of the L2s and trying to get a larger share of the ecosystem. So I believe that by the support, first of all, with the foundation, with the community, it's a huge community, right? The largest of all the chains that we know. Altogether, I think we are at such a right spot to like be in a very synergistic relationship where the projects need communities. No project works without community, you name any, right? And then once that is done, more and more projects can come on the chain, come into the ecosystem, help each other reach more masses. If we are reaching maybe smallholder marginal farmers in India, someone else could be reaching blue-collar workers in Australia or anywhere else, right? There are still so many projects and things that can still come on the chain, and I think now is the right spot, right time to do that. So that's what we are looking for to it.
Incredible, thank you. I'm just incredibly honored to be sharing the stage here with you all, and we've got a few minutes left here, so maybe we'll just take a few questions and then we'll call it a day. So, gentleman with the blue shirt, you put your hand up first. Yeah. Yeah, and sorry, if you could maybe, we'll just pass the mic over to you.
Hello, fellow Latin American here. It's good to hear that this is doing some good. I want to know if. Well, as I understand, you are all using the blockchain more to register people or the hashes of their information. So are you planning to use that information and that identity, you being a verifier, so that, for example, they can use a protocol similar to the proof of humanity that was here around an hour ago? So that, for example, you can prove that person exists more than just that person being able to receive a loan.
Yeah, I definitely see us contributing to proof of humanity. For example, what represents a person for us is a transaction which is hashed. So if the details of the person, as the same way we do the passwords, can be hashed, because we don't do that, we just do the entire thing, then we can contribute in some way, because that hash is a combination of their location, of their names, their phone number registered in government, and many other details. So we feel looking at how how can we use this hash to prove it's the truth. Yeah, the ZK rollup ETC, I think it's part of the thing that can work.
So yeah, I just want to add to that. Likewise, we also do not put the direct details. It's not right, you know, because you have a right to, you need to give a right to forget, right? Once you put all their PIIs onto the blockchain, you cannot forget them. So these are the challenges. But yeah, somewhere if we can, taking more solutions and bringing some sort of identity on blockchain, like from the foundation, I was having a very good discussion regarding, so in India, we have Aadhaar, which is like with 1.4 billion people. If we onboard that onto the blockchain, just imagine what kind of identification can that be, right? And then you can subsequently use it possibly across other chains, you know, cross chain as well. But yeah, it will always have some challenges. It will have, barriers to entry as well. But at this moment, I don't think that a lot of people are putting identity directly on blockchain, or maybe combining it with some sort of DID, decentralized identity, and making it work, but not in 100% of it.
Yeah, in my opinion, I think it could be interesting combining reputation with proof of humanity, because that makes, if someone... for example, didn't pay a saving circle, they get a bad reputation in their wallet and it's permanent, right? Then they can just change wallets, right? But linking that to proof of humanity, I think that's interesting. For the moment, we're not putting any personal information on chain. It's your wallet. If you paid or you didn't pay, it's stored with the event of the smart contract, and that's how it's tracked.
Thank you. Yeah, sure, right there. Second row.
Thank you. Hi, Sion. The principal, the capital, comes from DeFi or CeFi? And the interest rate, the initial, what is approximately how much pay of interest the taker?
Sure.
Thank you.
I think that the question is to me anyway. So, that's the beautiful part of the entire platform. Since 2.5 years, banks have already been giving loans on the platform, 7 million till now. That's completely centralized finance loan, as you can see. Now, once we go live on the mainnet, it would be DeFi loans as well. They would be disjointed amongst themselves, right? The CeFi and DeFi part, but the farmer would have access to both from the click of a button. So you see, it's a bridge. It's not we are stopping one and starting another. It's just that we are bridging. In fact, yeah, so that's what is the need of the hour at this moment. And whenever the farmer would see that, okay, one, CeFi has a lower interest rate or DeFi has a lower interest rate, they can just go ahead and choose that option. Farmer has nothing to do with which I'm specifically choosing, right? One point here is that for the DeFi solution, we would also need an off-ramp solution, because you can imagine, I can just go ahead and give USDC to a farmer and say that, okay, yeah, you know, buy your next crops, next season cycle for that with that USDC. So that is a challenge. You asked about interest rate. It is currently 9% per annum. So it's very low. It's one of the lowest in India. And we have seen across other countries as well that this interest rate is very, very low in the market. And once we go on DeFi, we're expecting somewhere around 7 to 11% again, which is a very stable interest rate in terms of DeFi.
I'm personally really excited for when a farmer in India can buy their crops with crypto.
That's right, yeah. Something to be excited about.
Yeah. So Deepa there, and this will be the last question, and then we'll just close things
up. Yeah, I just wanted to say that Ethereum Foundation has done a great job by uniting four, I don't know how many fellows are there in altogether.
There's
seven
in the second
fellows,
cohort.
And now y'all are talking to each other and y'all are collaborating and learning from each other. But there are many other projects in the Ethereum ecosystem and that are reaching to the next billion people. Like there's Good Dollar, there's Proof of Humanity, there is HumanDAO. HumanDAO is actually bringing work to people, providing economic opportunities. So I think it's very important that maybe we need to form like a next billion DAO or something where everybody can be in one group, and then on top of your services, you can provide their services and stuff like that, and learn from each other. Because, for instance, Good Dollar is in over 200 countries. And as part of my study, because I'm writing a book on impact DAOs, HumanDAO and Good Dollar were part of my studies, and they got to learn about each other, and now they're working together, in a lot of countries that they're going to. So I think it's very important that we start like a next billion DAO or something like that.
I think that's like a really, really fascinating idea. And I mean, I think that's a lot of the work that I'm doing is basically ecosystem research. And what will come out of that is basically a whole ecosystem map of different folks working on these specific solutions, sort of focusing on DeFi. So I think that's a great proposition. I don't know if there's anything else you guys, yeah.
No, it's just similar to where we were talking about yesterday, like how to gather these projects in an organized, trustworthy way. So interesting question.
Yeah, I think DAOs are pretty early still because, you know, so many more use cases are coming on DAO. But I think that's a good idea. Next, you know, DAO for the next billion is going to be a good.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good thing to explore, and congratulations on your book.
Yeah. Awesome. So just last minute, maybe just a quick go around. Where can people find your work? Where can they find you? And yeah, we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, you can find us at Bloinks, B-L-O, like a block with the sound of a pig, where you put your piggy bank savings. Nice. That's it.
You can find me on Twitter at Ben Juguna, on Instagram. Twitter is Benson underscore Juguna. On Telegram, it's at Ben Juguna. And email benjuguna at ecafrica, and website ecafrica.com.
Yeah, so for me, it's the product name is Whrrl, W-H-R-R-L, comes from Warehouse Receipt Lending with an extra R in between. Or just search for Abhishek Bhattacharya. Twitter is that, Abhishek Bhattacharya @. Yeah, that's all. So I think you should be able to find this online. From the agenda anyway, it's there.
Incredible. Thank you. Yeah.
How about you, Marcus? How to find you?
Marcus.am is my website and my Twitter as well. And yeah, thank you so much. Big round of applause for these incredible panelists.